I'm speaking today with Dr. Terry Greer, who is the superintendent of HISD. Dr. Greer, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me today. I'd like to ask, to start off, what was it that drew you to Houston, and what do you see as the current state of HISD?
Well, what drew me to Houston, frankly, was the school board, the Board of Education. I was very happy in San Diego. We were going through some very tough financial times. We had cut over $200 million out of our budget. We were facing additional cuts. But the search firm that was conducting the superintendent search for Houston called several times, and I said wasn't interested. Called several more times. I said I wasn't interested. And then I started getting some advice from some colleagues and friends and mentors, and basically it really came down to people feeling that this would be a good match. The Board of Education had a very clear vision and belief statement, which talked about student academic performance as being their priority, their primary goal. And I decided to go online and started reading, and the more I read about the board, the district, where it had been, where the board said it wanted to go, I started thinking, well, maybe I should have a conversation. And so I did, and it went from there.
Okay. What do you see as being the current status of HISD and your top priorities?
I think HISD is a good school district that has the potential to be really a great district. I would like to see the district become the best school system in America. Not the best urban district, but the best district. And I don't say that lightly. I mean it. It's just not wasting your breath. It's something I really do mean. We are a district that is doing a lot of great things. We have a lot of programs we can point to that we can say, here are examples of excellence. But I can also say that we have 70,000 children that are reading below grade level. I can say that we have a dropout rate that's unacceptable. We have a graduation rate that is too low. That's a bit of where we are and a bit of where I would like to see us go.
What types of things do you have in mind? What specific things do you want to do to address the problems of, below par reading performance, low graduation rate, and high dropout rate?
Yeah, there's a lot that we want to do, but I think that at the bottom of it and at the top and in between is trying to do what we need to do to make sure we have a quality teacher in every classroom. And by quality, let me define that a bit. It's a teacher who can produce at a minimum 1 year of academic growth for that year of educational experience in that classroom. I believe that we have to have a quality principal leading every school. Now, I'm not talking about just good people. We have a lot of good people. I'm talking about people who can get the job done as far as student academic achievement is concerned.
Okay. Talking about teachers, and obviously there's been a certain amount of friction between you and the Houston Federation of Teachers since you took this job. Do you see that as an impediment?
I certainly hope not. I like Gail Fallon, who's the president of the teachers' union. Gail has a job to do. She's her job primarily is focused around serving her members. My job is focused around serving the needs of children and making sure that our parents' needs are met. I want to have a school system in Houston where none of our children leave school because they feel that their needs are not being met. And by leave, I mean either dropping out or going into a charter school or a private school. I don't believe parents leave public education and go into private or charter schools if they feel their children's educational needs are being met.
Okay. Since you're talking about having a teacher in every classroom that will help students gain a year or more of academic improvement in the course of a school year, what metric do you use to evaluate them? What is the best way to evaluate a teacher's performance?
Well, one of the ways, there's a lot of ways to evaluate a teacher's performance, and a lot of it just stems from what you observe when you go in to see a teacher teach, whether or not that teacher's students are engaged, whether or not the lesson is relevant. You look at the relationship between the teacher and the student. You look at office referrals, how well the teacher manages the classroom. You look at the teacher attendance, You look at whether or not they are tardy coming to school on a regular basis. You look at relationship between teacher and teacher, between teacher and principal, between teacher and student, between teacher and parent. There's a lot of things you look at. You also have to pay careful attention to student academic performance. In HISD, for a number of years now, the district has used student value-added test data. It's an analysis of data over time to see whether or not students grow at the rate that they're projected to grow based on their past performances. And it's not magic. The formula that the district uses has been posted on the Houston Chronicle website. We're trying to be very transparent with that concept. Basically, what that means is that if you and I teach next door to each other in the same elementary school, and we're both teaching fourth grade, and we're both teaching fourth grade math, science, social studies, and language arts, and we're teaching children from the very same neighborhood, from the very same socioeconomic background, the same ethnic background, and we both have 8 years of experience, and we both have master's degrees, and yet your students are achieving at a significantly higher rate than are mine. For us as a school district to turn a blind eye to my students' lack of academic performance, I think would be a travesty. I think it would be disingenuous on our part to sit back and say, oh, teachers don't make a difference. I happen to believe that teachers are the difference makers.
I mean, the HFT disputes the transparency of the data, the value-added data that you're talking about. They say that that while the mathematical model is public information, the underlying code used to generate it is not. Is that a concern?
You know, Charles, last year, before I came to work here, it's my understanding that we sent 8 of our teachers to Cary, North Carolina, who spent several days there talking with Bill Sanders and his staff, who are the ones that do the aggregation and disaggregation of the data that we use. Teachers came away feeling very comfortable with that trip, very comfortable with the process. If you don't want to use value-added data, what do you want to use? Do you want to use SAT scores? Do you want to use advanced placement test scores? What is it that people want to use? What concerns me is that there are those among us who want us to treat all teachers the same, regardless of the types of performance that they are able to help elicit from their children. And by performance, I want to be clear, I'm talking about academic growth performance. I don't think we can become the best school district in America if that's our philosophy. Our philosophy cannot be to protect the status quo. Our philosophy cannot be to protect those who either will not or cannot educate our children.
So what is the plan to deal with teachers who are not measuring up, and how, you know, where do you see a cutoff point between acceptable and not acceptable?
Well, it's interesting. We have invited our teachers union here in Houston to come to the table, so to speak, and sit down with us and help us to design meaningful staff development programs for our teachers. Not only the first, second, third year teachers. I'm talking about teachers in our school district that have 16 or 17 years of experience, but whose students' test scores are so low that you would not want one of your children in that teacher's classroom. And we have not had, they have not taken us up on that invitation. It is an open invitation, by the way. It does not have to be my way or the administration's way. We want a true partnership with our teachers and with our teachers association. We do not see this as being a situation where we have to be banging heads all the time. We're not going to always see eye to eye. Their issues are frankly centered around adults. Al Shanker, the former president of the American Federation of Teachers, which our current teachers are an affiliate of, once said, when students start paying dues, I'll start focusing on students' interest. I think that says it all. We have teachers here in Houston that are as good as you'll find anywhere in America. anywhere in the world. We have exemplary teachers doing a phenomenal job. Unfortunately, we have a small group of teachers who are not meeting our students' needs. And we need to work with those teachers. We need to provide training for those teachers. But to be frank, after an adequate amount of time, if after all that training and all that additional work, all that mentoring and support and help, that those teachers cannot or will not meet the needs of our students, they can't stay in our organization.
Okay. One other area of dispute right now between the board and teachers concerns the disciplinary alternate education program that's currently run by a community education partner, CEP. You are instituting a review of CEP. What is it you're looking for, and you know what is your issue with how CEP has been used?
Well, frankly, it's a simple issue. We're spending $22 million at CEP for services that they provide to approximately 1,600 students during a year. And I want to add that no time during the year that I'm aware of are 1,600 students present. Usually there's 400 students there, 600 students there, maybe 800 students there. It grows as the year progresses. I've simply said from day one, $22 million is too much money. And it is. And what's fascinating to me about this whole process is, why is Ms. Fallon, particularly Ms. Fallon, so interested in this contract with CEP? Now, if it's an issue of serving these children, there's other options. And I'm not saying that we should move away from the contract with CEP, but for example, the Harris County Office of Education provides these same services to children all over Harris County. You don't hear any complaints about that. You don't read about it in the paper as not being good services, and it's a lot cheaper. Now, I'm not advocating one way or another, but why is it the objection to contract with CEP? Now, if we were coming in and saying we were eliminating services altogether, I could understand that. Because I want to be clear. I was a teacher. My daughter is a fifth grade teacher in an all Title I school, Columbia, South Carolina. My stepdaughter is a first grade teacher. I clearly understand as a former principal that you have to have discipline in a school. I clearly understand that there may be students who cannot function in a school because they're so disruptive and they need to be in an alternative educational environment. But the issue here doesn't seem to be a question about whether or not we provide those services. It just seems to be almost an obsession that those services have to be provided by this particular provider. I find that kind of strange and interesting.
Okay. In some of the news coverage that I've read about this process, you know, examining CEP, I've seen you say that you know some students have been referred to CEP for minor infractions. Mm-hmm. Given especially that there's a relatively small number of students in CEP to begin with, and since it seems like according to HISD's own website, there are certain things that require being sent to CEP, and certain other things that you know where there's discretion involved. I mean, how many students do you believe have been referred for minor infractions, and can you give me an example of such?
I'll give you a lot of examples. Let's be clear so that your listeners understand what we're talking about here. In Texas, there is state law that is very clear and specific about certain incidences of behavior that occur in schools that are so serious that the students have to be expelled from school. Those particular situations, those students are usually referred to, and by law referred to, the juvenile court system, the juvenile justice system. So when we have students like that who misbehave in our school, they're not sent to CEP. They're sent to JJAEP here in Harris County. And I met today with Henry Gonzalez, who is their deputy director of the Harris County Juvenile Probation Department. And I'll give you this chart that he gave me if you would like. And it basically shows you the number of students from the Houston Independent School District that was sent to them for this type of very serious offense. Let's just, for discussion purposes, call those Tier 1 offenses, even though that's my terminology, not the state's or not Harris County's.
We refer to that as Tier 5, actually, or Level 5.
Okay, let's say Level 5. Those Level 5 students, again, are sent not to CEP, but are sent to Harris County's Juvenile Probation Department. We have a contract with them for $1.7 million a year. Then there's this other group of students that, by our own code of conduct, if a student there is involved in behavior such as possession of drug paraphernalia, etc., they can be sent then to CEP. Those are mandatory reasons under our own local code of conduct that basically is maybe a degree below what the state requires or several steps below, so they go to CEP. Then there is another category that is discretionary, that principals can send kids to alternative settings, and it can be for kid that is just, it can range from things such as a kid just being chronically truant, or a kid that just will not listen to an adult supervision or direction. Those kids, the kids that go to CEP, two-thirds of the kids that are sent there for discretionary purposes. Now, the interesting thing is that if a kid is expelled from CEP, they are sent to the Harris County Juvenile Probationary Department, and we have to pay for that kid to go there, even though they are expelled from CEP. So we're paying for them to go to the traditional high school. If they get sent out of there, then we pay for them to go to CEP, $19 to $22 million, depending on the way you look at it. And then we have to pay a third time after CEP expels them. So it's kind of fascinating, the expense that's tied to all of this. Now, again, I want to be clear about something. I don't think you've ever read or seen anywhere where I have questioned the quality of what CEP does. They have had their critics, they've had their supporters. What you have consistently heard me say is that it costs $22 million to serve a relatively small number of children. And the ones that are dangerous have already been removed by law and placed over at our juvenile probation department. They're already gone. So we have these other students, some of whom may have had a beer at a basketball game and got caught, some of whom may have had drug paraphernalia with them, some of them who have maybe gotten into a fight in school that was a little more severe than you and I would have liked, and probably have no business at that school. Maybe someone who shoved a teacher or who said threatening things to a teacher. Kids who truly don't need to be in school given that type of behavior. We have moved them into an alternative educational setting, in this case, many times CEP. And then we have these discretionary kids that we've also sent to CEP. All I have said from day one is when you look at that contract, that is one of the largest contracts we have with a single vendor in the Houston Independent School District. I think it needs to be reviewed. I think we need to look at it carefully. I think we need to ask ourselves, are there other ways that we could meet the needs of some of these students that have been discretionarily suspended? We have seen already this year, and as I talked to Henry Gonzalez, Henry told me that they are seeing all over Harris County, and they have seen in the last 5 years, a decrease in the number of kids being expelled from school. Now, whether it's because kids are becoming better behaved, or we don't know. But we also this year, through our own records, have seen fewer kids referred to CEP. And no one on my staff has told principals, and principals will tell you this, no one has told them not to send kids to CEP. We've got principals in our school district who will not send kids to CEP. For high school, the principal will not send a kid to CEP. Lamar High School, the principal will not send a kid to CEP. Lamar High School has established their own alternative school to send their kids to that cannot function at Lamar High School. Now, if you want to ask those two principals and other principals, why would you not want to send your kid to CEP? You're free to go do that. Lamar High School, Furr High School, those are two that come to mind. Okay. So I'm not anti-CEP. I'm not anti-alternative school. My question is always centered around how could we spend $22 million and no one questioned that amount?
Okay. You have proposed as one possible alternative a student swap system where a student who is needs to be removed from one school, perhaps to be placed in another, with a mentor provided for guidance for them. Again, from what I've seen in the news coverage, it looks like while this has been tried in some places, it doesn't really have a very long track record to evaluate.
It's fascinating. It's not new to Houston. We've done that here for years. Principals will tell you that they've made those type of informal arrangements with other principals here in the past. And it's sometimes very successful, at least sometimes not so. Now, I would ask you this. If you and I were two middle school principals or two high school principals, and we had this swap arrangement, as your terminology, and so you have a kid at your school that has done something that you believe would necessitate them having a change of scenery, if you will. But you don't think they can be successful in your school for whatever reason. Not a dangerous kid. That kid's already been put out of school and is already over at the Harris County Juvenile Probation Department. But I'm talking about a student for whatever reason you think needs to leave your school. So you sit down with that student and that parent and you say to them, I have an option for you. You can attend school over at Terry Greer's Middle School. Here's a contract you have to sign that says you have to be in attendance on a regular basis. You must study. You must behave yourself. So your option is to either go over to Terry's school or to go to CEP. That's an option for you. Now let's be clear. The very first time at Terry's school, you do not honor this contract. Very first time, zero tolerance, first time. You cross the line, you misbehave, you violate their code of conduct, you get involved in a fight, you do some of the same things you've done here at my school, you're going that day to CEP. That's an option for you as a parent. That's a description of what we're talking about. I believe you would have some students that would, parents that might say, send me to CEP. You may have others that would say, this is a preferable option for me. You may have a group of kids that would come to my school and behave and could work their way eventually back to your school after a 45-day period at my place or a grading period or whatever we decided on. Or they might like my place well enough and they may behave well enough that they wanted to stay there during the year. The key to this is if he comes to my place and he misbehaves, I know as a principal, my assistant principals know, the person that I've got assigned to be a mentor to him knows, or her, the very first time they step out of line to where I don't think they should be at my school, they go straight to CEP. Now, what is there about that you find concerning?
Well, as I said, the only indications I've seen so far from what I've read is that it was tried before in Philadelphia without much success, and that same superintendent is trying it now in New Orleans.
We have this program, as I said to you, that we're talking about as one of several different options. Has been tried with some success here in Houston. It's been tried in other districts where I had worked with a great deal of success. Will it work for every student? You've heard me say no. If it doesn't work for me, what happens? You go straight back to CEP or to a CEP type setting. What is the risk involved for you?
I suppose there's not that much.
I would suppose there's not that much. What is the potential benefit from the student if they take advantage of this new opportunity?
Well, they get to stay in a regular school.
There you go. The key has to be that the receiving principal, number one, would only accept a handful of these students. Number two is they have to have complete control over if that student's behavior ever becomes unacceptable immediately, that student can be removed and go to an alternative setting. See, that way you protect your teachers, you protect your other students. You have to have learning environments that are conducive to kids being able to be successful in your school.
Okay. Let's talk about another topic here. As you know, recently the Obama administration, Department of Education, handed out their Race to the Top grants to a couple of states. Only two of them got it. There's going to be another round, which even though Governor Perry instructed the Texas Education Association to not apply for them, the Obama administration has made it clear that individual school districts may apply for these funds. Do you envision HISD applying for them?
You know, what I would hope is that we could take a close look at that grant application and see what's contained within that grant application, and then be able to sit down with our school board, with our teachers, with our principals, with our community, and to say, do you think this is something that could benefit our children here in Houston? And I think that our school board, as our duly elected decision makers and school officials in Harris County and in Houston, ought to be the ones making that decision. With all due respect, I don't think that should be the governor. I don't think that should be members of our legislature. It ought to be the school board. So I would hope that we could take a look at that grant if we're given the opportunity in the future, and we could ask ourselves, could this benefit our students? If so, is there anything in that grant that would be problematic to us or that may push us in a direction that the board would not want to go, that would be inconsistent with their values and beliefs? And if so, the board would be the ones that would make the decision, no, we're not going to apply.
I would assume one of the main concerns would be that you would get the money for a year or 2 years or whatever, but it wouldn't be ongoing, and then the school district would be on the hook to pay for whatever it is.
I think it's, quite frankly, I think that we're faced with that right now. With our stimulus dollars that Houston Independent School District received, we spent more of those stimulus dollars for salaries and people than any other large urban school district in America. Now, those monies are going to go away next year. We're going to have to notice a lot of people next year and say, you don't have your job because this money went away.
Well, that's an issue for the legislature, though, isn't it?
That's an issue for our school district, because they have contracts with us, not with the legislature. And so we're going to be put in a position where at the end of next year, when that money goes away, because we've been told clearly we will not get that money again. So we will notice people, but the money has gone away, and now, unfortunately, so has your job. So some of those folks are going to have contracts with the district, and we're going to have to find them jobs. So we may find ourselves in a position, in some cases, I hope not, but we may, to be very transparent, where we're having to non-renew a probationary teacher that may be doing an exemplary job, because we have to find a job for a teacher with a term or a continuing contract.
Now, as you know, the legislature in 2006 basically froze the amount of, the level of funding for school districts at the time when they did a property tax cut to comply with a Supreme Court ruling. What do you hope will happen in this legislative session? I mean, obviously there's a budget deficit that they're looking at. What is HISD's financial situation in addition to what you talked about, and what will you be lobbying the legislature for?
Well, I can tell you, as a school district, I think we are more fortunate than most in the country and most in Texas. We have had a visionary board of education that has provided strong financial oversight. We have one of the best chief financial officers in the country working for us. We have managed our district, I believe, very well from a financial perspective. Having said that, like the rest of the country, the national economy is catching up to Texas. It's going to catch up to Houston. A large percentage of our revenue here that comes from our tax base is sent to other school districts across the state. So we're finding ourselves looking at a financial shortfall for the coming year. We will have to make some internal adjustments. We've already eliminated 70 central office positions. We're probably going to eliminate 40 or 50 more to try to help balance that budget. But I think long term, I don't see the economy turning around nationally or even in the state to the degree that we're going to find schools funded at the level that I think they need to be. I think we need to pay our teachers more, for example. I worry that our school year is not long enough for some of our students who need more time. So we've got to proceed with caution with how we account for our dollars, but we're in better shape than most.
Okay. As you know, in 2007, voters approved a large bond referendum to build some new schools and do a lot of improvements on schools. What is the current status of that, you know, of that referendum, or I should say, of the construction and all the work that was
Frankly, Charles, we're catching up. I'm concerned, and was concerned when I first came to work here, that we're a bit behind on schedule, and I think we were. But we're catching back up, and we're moving those projects along. We have developed a website for the school projects in an effort to be more transparent. Our staff is developing a time frame for each one of the projects, and you can go to that website. It'll show you school by school, kind of like a pin dot map you see on Google. You can click on, it'll show you the school, it'll show you the amount of money in the budget, it'll show you what is supposed to be built or renovated in that school, and I'll show you the timeline of when the work is to begin and when the work is to end. We also are going to work to send staff out to provide video streaming on the project as the project progresses, so that you can go to each one of the sites and you can literally see the renovation or the construction go on as we progress through the project.
Okay. There was a news story a while back talking about school lunches, and there was a quote from you in there about how Houston couldn't afford, I forget the exact term, Cadillac lunches or Premier lunches, I forget, referring to fresh fruits and vegetables. I know some people who are not too happy about the way that was said, my wife being one of them.
Well, here's the issue with all that. It was not said in any way to offend anyone. We want our children to deserve to receive the very best meals that we can afford. The real issue here with us as a school district is that 80% of our children are on free and reduced lunch. So a big part of the revenue that we generate is paid for by the federal government. The other children in our district who are not on free and reduced lunch, the paying students, the amount of money that they pay for their food is a small, small percentage of our revenue that we generate. So what's happening right now during the school year, we're looking at a $12 to $13 million shortfall in our cafeteria budget for this year. HISD, before I ever came to work here, built a new centralized school preparation, or food preparation facility. And we spent about $29 million putting equipment in that new facility. Basically what that means is that food is not being cooked in our cafeterias. It's being prepared in this central facility. It's being packaged and shipped to our schools on a daily basis. And schools then have to heat that food and serve it versus cook it and serve it. And what happened before I came here is Airmark, who manages our cafeteria program and our staff, took a look at our budget and quickly recognized that when you shift from a food preparation facility at the school level to one at a centralized area, you need fewer hours in the local cafeterias. You do not need people to work there 7-8 hours a day. You may need people to work there 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours to heat the food. They were supposed to make that adjustment in staffing this past summer. For whatever reason, that did not happen. And quite frankly, it should have happened in the summer where we could have taken care of a lot of it through attrition. We might could have found some of our cafeteria workers whose hours had been cut. Perhaps we could have found them jobs as teacher assistants, as custodians, as bus drivers, etc. It did not happen. So what we find ourselves in the position right now is that our staff last year developed a cafeteria menu which exceeded the federal cafeteria group in Washington, D.C., and I struggle with the proper name. I think it has to do with, believe it or not, the federal food program. The oversight is administered by the Agricultural Department,
but it exceeds all of their nutritional guidelines. They have guidelines, for example, that controls the amount of fat or the amount of protein that's in a serving of food in a child's classroom. The cost of the menu is driven by things such as the number of servings of fresh fruit per day. And so that particular group, according to our cafeteria department, has a certain federal standard. You can exceed that federal standard by having what they call a regular standard, then you can have a silver standard, a gold standard, a platinum standard. Those standards are defined by the federal government, and those standards have a lot to do with how many servings of fresh fruit you serve, whether or not your rolls are multigrain or whole wheat, whether or not your milk is 1% or regular whole milk. All of that's driven by federal standards. What I probably did not say very well, and would like to apologize to your wife and anyone else I offended, because that was not my intent. What we were trying to say is, it's costing us right now about 7 cents more per plate than we generate in revenue. And that is the revenue we generate not just from the paying parent, but it's revenue we generate from the federal government. So our options are, we continue to have that platinum standard, which I wish we could afford. We continue to do that, or we have to make menu adjustments to get our cost per serving back in line with the amount of revenue per serving that we receive. We either do that, or we're going to face the same $12 to $13 million shortfall that we have every year. Now, so adjusting that cost per serving is not just going from serving fresh fruit 5 days a week to having fresh fruit 3 days a week and canned fruit 2 days a week. It also has to do with the number of hours our cafeteria workers work. It has to do with the amount of food that is being sold by our high schools, for example, through private vendors during the lunch hour. Because if you're buying pizza or chicken sandwiches from a third party and you're not eating in the cafeteria, that certainly has an impact on the revenue. So the comment I made had nothing to do with my desire to see us lower the quality of the food we serve. And I like to eat too much. I like to eat good food. And I want our kids to eat. And I want them to eat well. The issue for all of us, though, is we could raise, right now we're going to look at recommending to our board to raise prices of our lunches a small amount next year for students. And we're going to talk about that with our board tomorrow. But we could raise our prices significantly for the paying students. It still wouldn't offset that $12 to $13 million. So it has to be a combination of adjusting your employee work hours to be more in line with what you actually need to prepare the food centrally, warm it, and serve it in the schools, along with menus, that the cost of what you serve in those menus and those employee hours will help you get your cost per plate back in line with your revenues, or the Board of Education would have to decide, we're going to continue to have a menu that meets standards above the federal and state regulations. And to do that, we're going to cut $15 million, $12 million, $13 million, whatever we need to. We'll cut it from somewhere else. What I can tell you, finding that amount of money from somewhere else would be very, very difficult to do.
Some schools have partnered with organizations like Recipe for Success or Urban Harvest to bring more fresh fruits and vegetables into their schools. Is that something you would like to see done more of in HISD?
Oh, absolutely. Those are fantastic programs, and I've met one of the executive directors that run one of those programs, and it's just phenomenal what they're doing. And absolutely, sure, we would all like to do that. It gets down again to this issue.
I was going to say, is that something that can be afforded?
That's the question. That is the big question. If you talk to them, I think they believe that there's ways that they can help make that more affordable. And I think that's something we need to spend some time paying attention to in the district. I really do. But again, I want to come back to this. It's not an issue of thinking that we could ever have a quality that would be too high for our students. That's not the message at all. The message primarily is how do you, it's a business issue. A lot of people don't understand that our cafeteria by law has to be a separate, what they refer to as an enterprise department. They have to be able to operate on the revenues that they generate. And if you made any profit in the cafeteria program, you can't spend it somewhere else in the district. So we're not trying to make profit. We're just simply trying to balance the amount that it costs to prepare a meal with the revenue that you generate from the sale of that meal.
Okay. Dr. Greer, thank you very much for your time today.
Awesome.
I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. It's so good talking with you.